Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekend, a glossy audio supplement on Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... Last weekend, the Israeli LGBTQ community celebrated its annual Pride Parade in Tel Aviv. Over 100,000 people filled the streets of the city, waving Israeli and rainbow flags and enjoying a carnival atmosphere in glorious sunshine. Concerns over a spike in COVID infections were not the only cloud hovering over this year's celebrations, however. Foreign Minister and alternate Prime Minister Yair Lapid sparked outrage amongst far-right politicians when he flew the rainbow flag atop the foreign ministry, and the Chief Rabbi of Jerusalem once again referred to that city's pride parade as an abomination, comparing participants to wild animals. Meanwhile, a much-heralded law that would ban so-called conversion therapy is stuck somewhere in the Knesset, despite having the unprecedented support of some Arab MKs. And with a small but vocal group of homophobic Knesset members inciting hatred, violence, and in some horrific cases, murder against the LGBTQ community, not everything is rosy in a country that likes to think of itself as a gay-friendly paradise. Joining me today to discuss a spectrum of LGBTQ issues in Israel, I'm delighted to welcome Haaretz.com's Linda Dayan and LGBTQ activist Mohammed Zoabi. Good to have you both here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get cracking, I have to get to the bottom of something. When we were messaging about today's recording, Mohammed, I discovered that you and Linda did IDF reserve duty together. The story of how you ended up doing Miluim with an American immigrant from New Jersey is probably worth a podcast on its own. But I think that many of our listeners would be surprised to hear that a gay Muslim from Nazareth served in the Israeli army at all. How did that happen?
So yeah, it's true. Linda was doing reserves when I was actually doing my military service. I served at the IDF spokesperson unit. How I ended up there, it's a very long story. I mean, I can tell you that I started my military service in 2017, and I met Linda for the first time, I think, in 2018, if I'm not mistaken. She came to help us during one of the drama days that were happening. That's how we got to know each other. But everything is very dramatic here. So,
your backstory is probably worth more than one podcast on its own. I'm going to let listeners Google your name and find out about your history. That's not the reason that we are gathered here today. So listen, Mohammed, I saw a photo of you online wearing a T-shirt with the slogan, "The Least Wanted Citizen, a Gay Arab." I don't know when that photo was taken. Do you still feel the same way?
So actually, that photo was taken when I was still in the army, back in also 2018. The government of Israel, the last government, to me at least, felt like it was trying to purposely hurt my feelings for multiple reasons. And that happened basically when it edited the surrogacy law in a discriminatory way that basically started a very big LGBTQ strike and protest. And a week after that, it legislated the nation state bill. And basically a week after the last legislation of the nation state bill, there was a protest, a very big rally in Rabin Square, and I thought, what's the best way to get all of my identity circles or my different struggles here in this country all combined together? And I thought, oh, it would be interesting to wear a shirt with that slogan, because that's how I felt. That's how I felt. I felt that not only that I'm being discriminated against for being an Arab citizen in this country, but I'm also being discriminated against as a gay man. And I definitely see a direct connection between my two struggles. They're an essential part of who I am and my experience here in this country.
And currently, with the new government, admittedly it's only been here a few days and nothing really has changed, but which part of that identity makes you feel more unwanted at the moment? The fact that you are gay or the fact that you're Arab?
Well, it really depends on the day, and it depends on the discourse of the conversation in that day, because, you know, things escalate in this country very fast. You know, things change and suddenly new things come up, and it really depends. You know, just a year ago, we were illegitimate coalition partners because that's what former Prime Minister Netanyahu determined for his rivals, and now suddenly we're part of the coalition. And not that we're only part of the coalition. I mean, the Arab party that's part of the coalition is literally the Islamic party of Mansour Abbas, which is one of the most conservative political parties in the Arab community. So it's very interesting to see, you know, the crazy and sharp shift between the conversation that was happening a year ago to the fact that now we have a government only thanks to the fact that, you know, the new coalition was able to negotiate the Islamic party and basically include them in the coalition and secure a parliamentary majority to oust Netanyahu. Mm. So, you know, it really depends.
But before we get on to talk a little bit about what this new government might mean for the LGBTQ Arab community in Israel, tell us a little bit about that community, because as you wrote in your op-ed, it's been very silent or silenced, perhaps.
It's true. The LGBTQ Arab community, I mean, the LGBTQ community in Israel in general has been going through what we would call here a revolution. In the last three decades, I mean, we've turned from a marginalized community in the 90s to a crucial part of mainstream Israeli culture nowadays. I mean, even though we don't really have equality secured in law, we are part of the mainstream political and social and cultural conversation in this country. But that being said, the LGBTQ movement has been very successful in that sense. It wasn't actually always able to include the sub-communities within the wider LGBTQ community in this country, and that basically includes the Arab LGBTQ community, the ultra-Orthodox LGBTQ community, the periphery LGBTQ community. And until a few years ago, you know, I'm 23 now, and I came out when I was 16. And when I first came out, I honestly didn't feel that there is an Arab LGBTQ community that I am part of, because I wasn't really, you know, growing up in the Arab community, but also growing up in the periphery. I grew up in the north. Talks about the LGBTQ movement weren't really that visible, especially not within the Arab circles of my surroundings. And what has been happening in the last 2 years, I would say, since 2019, is a shift in that. Basically, more and more, whether it be tragic incidents or good stuff, tragic as in, you know, the death of remarkable members of the Arab LGBTQ community, and positive would be, I guess, for example, the Al-Arz Tahini company announcement, basically, to support the LGBTQ community, which made it the first Arab-owned company in this country to actually do so publicly. So there's a lot of things that are happening that make us feel, I guess, that we're sort of are able to push ourselves into the mainstream conversation, both in general society in Israel, but also in particular in the Arab community in this country.
So what do you want? What are you demanding? Who are you demanding it from? Because it seems to me that the new Israeli government is one of the most gay-friendly ever, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, the leader of Noam, the homophobic party in Knesset, is always shooting off his mouth.
Well, I mean, yes, it's true. The current government is one of the most gay-friendly, but it also has one of the most homophobic members of parliament in it, which is the members of the Islamic movement. Just a reminder of, you know, talking about the Arab LGBTQ struggle, Mansour Abbas himself had said many LGBTQ remarks in the last year. His number two actually bragged about in a radio interview in Hebrew about the fact that in the Arab community we don't have that problem. He said that, quote, we don't have gay people in the Arab community because the majority of gay people in the Arab community don't even want to say that they're gay. End of quote. Obviously, they don't want to say that they're gay because there are people like, you know, Walid Taha who said that. And, you know, he's number two in the Islamic party, that basically, you know, make us want to be scared and hiding in our closet. So, I mean, it really depends on the day, as I said. I have a lot of demands and struggles, I guess, that I'm part of from the government. And I mean, the Islamic party now is a part of the government. So I see it as part of that struggle, but also, you know, with society and with the way people perceive us, whether it be the Arab community that doesn't always, you know, recognize our existence, but also the wider Israeli community that, you know, every time they meet an Arab LGBTQ person, they're shocked. oh, you can be gay and Arab, like, mm-hmm. you're not killed, like, wow, that's impressive. So it's multiple struggles that are basically for the sake of my own existence, you know, the recognition that I exist and that I'm able to exist and be who I am.
Mm. Last week, a coalition of 18 LGBTQ organizations launched a roadmap for LGBTQ rights in Israel. Were there any Arab groups involved in that initiative?
I'm not aware of exactly of the details of that proposal. I assume there are, you know, Arab LGBTQ individuals or public figures that are part of that. I don't know if there are organizations that are from the Arab community.
Mm. Linda, I understand that IGI, the Israel Gay Youth Organization, has now opened up support centers for Arab and ultra-Orthodox youths in Jerusalem. You're active with that organization. Tell us about those that outreach programs.
So IGI has groups all over the country for all sorts of young people ranging in ages from about 12 to about 24. And some of those groups are specifically intended for people who might need a bit more support within the community. There are Arab groups, there are religious groups, there are ultra-Orthodox groups, there are trans groups. And they've really been making an effort to expand those efforts, especially with regards to the ultra-Orthodox community and the Arab community, to make sure that, A, there's someone there to tell them, no, you're not alone. You're not the first person experiencing all this. To show them what kind of resources are available to them, especially when you're, say, under the age of 18 and you're still living in your parents' house. Mm-hmm. And you can't necessarily get to Tel Aviv. And you also might not necessarily want to leave your community. Mm-hmm. You might not want to leave your family behind and the entire support system that you have. And it shows you ways within these communities that you can not necessarily have it both ways, but find your community within your people if you want to, and to build a community within your people and to educate your community about LGBTQ issues, because so much of the problem comes from a lack of awareness and very intentional ignorance on behalf of some of the people leading.
So last week, for example, Hungary just passed a law barring LGBTQ organizations from interacting or even providing educational material to minors, to people under the age of 18. How have the communities, the ultra-Orthodox, the religious, the Arab communities reacted to IGI's programs? Have you had pushback at IGI from the leaders of those communities in the places? I mean, I understand that IGI opened up a center for LGBT youth in Beit Shemesh, for example, which is bordering between religious and Haredi town. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine that the rabbis in that town were particularly welcoming.
Every year there's pushback. And it's also in places that you'd never expect it. Expected so-called bastions of tolerance.
Like Mitzpeh Ramon, for example.
The mayor there said just this week that the LGBT community has an agenda, I think.
I think he said that the Mitzpeh Ramon municipality, Mitzpeh Ramon is a small town, you know, in the northern Negev. And he said that the Mitzpeh Ramon municipality or council shouldn't be focused on promoting communities. And thus it won't promote the LGBTQ community, and that LGBTQ people should understand that they're, as individuals, they're unique or something like that. And therefore, you know, they should sort of basically, you know, that LGBTQ individuals should work hard to get basically accepted only as individuals or something like that. Something very machoistic, very, you know, heteronormative, coming from a, you know, heterosexual man. I mean, it's
a former IDF officer, as it happens.
Yeah. So we do get pushback, but one of the nicer, I would say, aspects of IGI is that you find it when you look for it. A lot of the activities are kind of happening under the radar. We have a very unfortunate policy where we can't tell anybody where each group meets because mm-hmm. of one time at the Bal Noir, which is part of IGI, a man walked in with a gun and shot at the children who were there, and we still haven't caught him. So we are very careful to be discreet. Even like our group chats for the kids who are in the group can't be called like IGI or anything LGBT related. We come up with something at the beginning of the year and we stick with it. This year for our group, it's a High School Musical reference. So it's a lot harder for people to come out against the work that we do when they don't necessarily know about the work that we do, which, for better or for worse, it means that it's a little bit harder to get to the people who need it the most.
Mm.
But, I mean, coming from the United States where we didn't have anything like this, I do have to hand it to the education ministry and to the schools here that let the guides and counselors like myself and Iggy into schools to talk to the kids about the different activities that they have, to let them know that these resources are available and that they're welcome to come and use them.
Mm. And I have to comment on that, because for me, you know, one of my main struggles or one of my main challenges was the fact that in the educational system, at least in my time, didn't really include anything or barely included educational things about the LGBTQ community or movement. I mean, I can only imagine how much change that would, you know, that would make with me or with my experience if I had just at least one maybe lecture or gathering with Iggy or some other LGBTQ organization that was able to come into our school. But unfortunately, that never happened. Mm. I mean,
is it starting to happen now?
I'm not sure. I mean, maybe Linda can tell us more about this. But, you know, from what I know, in maybe, you know, in Tel Aviv or in other, you know, gay-friendly bubbles, sometimes people tend to think that, oh, if Tel Aviv is very LGBTQ-friendly, then, oh, the entire country must be LGBTQ-friendly because it's a small country. No, it really depends where you are. The country is very sectarian. It's very divided based on religious and community affiliation and whatever. And, you know, you could have a very gay-friendly community here, and then 5 minutes away, you could have a community that extremely homophobic that you wouldn't even think that you're in Israel.
Mm.
And so it really depends. But yeah, I guess Linda maybe could tell us more about that.
No, 100%. There's very much a side of the tracks thing going on. And I think sectarian is a great word for what's happening. It depends on the school. It depends on their staff.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I have a, and this is not related to Iggy necessarily, but it does kind of change the way that we think about the periphery and mixed cities, et cetera, et cetera. I have a good friend who came to Israel to be an English teacher via the Masa program, and she's openly transgender. And most schools said, we will not take her.
Wow.
But a school in Ramle said, you're giving us an English teacher who has an advanced degree, who's a native speaker. We don't care if she's got scales and horns. Like, bring her in. And she's very much beloved by her students.
Wow,
and
in, Ramle,
in Ramle.
In Ramle, which impressive. Is a conservative, mixed Jewish Arab.
And it's a suburb of Tel Aviv.
And it's very close to Tel Aviv.
Like
and,
15
and
minutes
very,
away.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there's also, when we get into it, when we talk about acceptance, it's a very loaded term. There'll also be people who accept LGBTQ people as individuals, kind of like what the mayor of Mitzpeh Ramon was talking about. And there will be people who accept the community as it is. And both of those are different kinds of acceptance.
Mm.
And both of them are expressed in very different ways within a community and towards individuals. Just because you are an LGBTQ person living in a supposedly homophobic area doesn't mean that you'll necessarily experience violence. And it doesn't necessarily mean that your neighbors will spit at you or throw things at you. They might very much accept you for being who you are. But that doesn't mean that there's necessarily going to be a pride parade going through the streets.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned maybe transgender related issues, because, you know, LGBTQ, we are one community, but we have a lot of sub communities and the challenges that we face also differ based on our either gender or sexual orientation and, you know, and who we are. You know, I think as a gay male, I think things can be much more easier for me than it would be for a transgender woman, for example, in this country, because the obstacles and the challenges that transgender people deal with are tremendous in comparison to what I deal with. So it's also important to remember that.
Mm. It's been well documented that Arab politicians in Israel are divided over whether to support some of the legislation that gay rights activists have been pushing for. Is this true of Israeli Arab society in general?
So I think we can take the Arab Joint List as an example. I mean, the Arab Joint List, which is basically a political bloc that was created as a as basically a combination of four different parties, secularist, Arab Jewish, and right-wing and centrist Arab parties with the Islamic party. They all united together and they ran together. And they got a record of seats, 15 seats at some point, which was, you know, the highest representation of an Arab political bloc in parliament. And it was basically, I would say, regardless of whether, you know, what we think of their policies or you know, the way they stand on things, it has been, I think, the most successful political project in the history of the Arab minority in this country. You know, being able to form what, sort of an inner Arab parliament or unity parliament within the Israeli parliament has been very impressive. And it actually blocked Netanyahu from forming a government at least twice because, you know, that's how representation, I guess, parliamentary systems work. The split that we've seen between the Islamic party and the mostly secularist three parties was mainly because of LGBTQ and religion and state-related issues, because the Islamic party basically demanded from Ayman Oude, the leader of the joint list, to basically commit and to sign on an agreement that he would not support any pro-LGBTQ legislations. And as far as I know, Ayman Oude refused to commit to that. And in addition to the different approach to whether, you know, they want to join the coalition or not, that basically resulted in the split that we know of between the Islamic party and the more secularist parties. This division in our political circles definitely represents a wider division in society. And for the first time, I mean, I feel that there has been always a lack of connection between what's happening in the Arab street and political arena. And finally, at least in that regard, in regards of, you know, the treatment of LGBTQ communities and also the issues of religion and state are being discussed publicly in a way that is influencing our politicians. And so I think, you know, the division in the political system between different Arab parties definitely represents the division in the Arab community itself. And you know, it's not just LGBTQ issues. It's religion and state issues. Suddenly, for the first time, the Arab community understands that it should take part in the wider conversation about the relationship between the religion and state in this country, and that, you know, this issue, you know, that the Jewish population, the Jewish majority, doesn't have monopoly over that issue. And that has definitely created a lot of divisions and a lot of fighting about it. And for the first, I mean, and not maybe not for the first time, but for the first time so strongly that I remember, that the liberal slash secular communities in the Arab community are voicing their demands and their approach. I mean, Labour MK Ibtissam Marani just recently spoke about it in an interview. She's a member now of the new government, but she was asked just a few weeks ago about the fact that she was actually accused of abandoning her Arab identity by a news anchor because she married a Jewish man. And her response to him was just perfect. She said to him, you know, if I was an Arab man, you probably would have not said that. You would have not accused me of abandoning my Arab identity simply for marrying a non-Muslim person. And then she gave an example of how many Arab men are married to non-Muslim women. And then she said, you know, I'm a secular person and I represent, you know, the secular parts of the Arab community. And it's about time that we should discuss these things more openly. And that is something that we've been seeing more and more happening, especially from the media side, the Arabic speaking media in the Arab community.
I was going to ask about that. What changed? Because the Arabic media kind of buried its head in the sand for a long time about LGBTQ issues.
Yep, it did. It definitely did. Look, there are taboos. I mean, we mentioned MK Ibtissam Marani, that is, she's very impressive and she's very outspoken on that issue. We can mention also MK Raida Rinawi, you know, Raida Rinawi Zoabi of Meretz, who said that she will not, I mean at least in the beginning, that she will not support LGBTQ legislation because she comes from a conservative community. So there is a sense you know, we as liberals and secularists in the Arab community have been canceling ourselves just so we don't anger, you know, Islamist and conservative elements in society. For me, that's over. Like, I'm not going to cancel myself just so I don't hurt someone else's feeling that is conservative. I mean, just, you know, just as conservative people have feelings, I also have feelings, and it's about time that my feelings are being respected and heard. And I think that the same process has been going through in the Arab media circles in this country, you know, there are taboo issues that they have not dared to talk about until recently. They saw that the political elite or the political circles have been sort of forced to deal with them. And so suddenly, in the last really 2 years, the Arabic media in this country has been creating storms, media storms in that issue, because they were daring to ask politicians questions like they did. They asked, MK Rinawi Zoabi from Meretz about whether she would support LGBTQ legislation or not. It doesn't always come from a place of solidarity with the LGBTQ community. There is a lot of machoism, heteronormative approaches to the issue. Even the terms that they use sometimes are very derogatory and very insulting. But I think it's a process that's starting.
Mm. Is any part of this reticence to deal with LGBTQ issues a fear of perhaps being dragged into the whole pinkwashing issue? Is there any sense that Israeli Arabs don't want to be adopted by those who say Israel is, as I said in the introduction, a gay-friendly paradise, therefore any other issues can be swept to one side?
Probably. I mean, I assume that there is some element or there is some factor that is related to that I guess makes it harder for Arab individuals or liberal Arab individuals in general in this country to always or to feel easily comfortable with taking a more productive or active part in the entire conversation. But I think, I mean, if we mention the issue of pinkwashing, I think it's important for us to remember that, you know, A lot of people ask me, especially when I meet students from abroad or people that are trying to learn more about the political system or the LGBTQ struggle in this country, and I always say, look, I remember the days when former prime minister, I can't believe I'm saying former prime minister.
It's
amazing. I mean, I don't know though what's more surreal, the fact that the fact that Bibi is not the prime minister, or the fact that we're sort of happy that Bennett is the prime minister. I mean, I don't know which is more surreal. Former prime minister, I remember a few times, he gave speeches at the UN and in different places, and even in the Congress he mentioned it, I think, bragging about how gay couples can walk hand in hand in Tel Aviv and hold hands. And then when he comes back to the country, he votes against pro-LGBTQ legislation. Mm-hmm. So if we talk about pinkwashing, that's pinkwashing. When the political elite or political figures use our struggle as a tool to, justify or to brag about, oh, we're such a gay friend. We don't kill our gays like the Iranians do. How amazing is that? So that's pinkwashing. But the entire conversation about the LGBTQ movement in Israel or coloring all of it as pinkwashing is actually insulting to us as LGBTQ individuals in this country, because nobody is doing us a favor. I mean, it's not like we got our rights or the rights that we got so far, which is basically not everything. It's not like we got it on what we say in Hebrew, magashel zahav,
on a silver platter.
Yeah. Exactly. We fought for this. Mm-hmm. We fought in parliament to get parliament to abolish all anti-gay laws. We fought in the courts to get the courts to basically force the government to recognize us in whether it be in marriage, like, for example, if you marry abroad, whether you are a heterosexual couple or a same-sex couple, if you marry abroad and you come back, the state has to recognize you thanks to the Supreme Court. So we are leading a struggle that is hard and fierce, that is not always necessarily connected to, Israel's crimes or the bad things that Israel does. I mean, if we look at the LGBTQ community in this country, it's one of the most pro-Palestinian communities, at least in the political circles and the social circles. So to cancel us and say that, everything we do is pinkwashing is really unfair and insulting, and it really cancels our struggle that has been going on for decades now. And it's just really unfair.
Mm. Yeah, I pitched my first op-ed at Haaretz and wrote my first op-ed at Haaretz about this subject exactly. And I want to co-sign literally everything that Mohammed just said. LGBTQ people in Israel exist as individuals and not just as political entities. Mm-hmm. I cannot stress enough that the Orthodox kid who came in to the Tel Aviv Pride Parade in secret from Jerusalem, told his parents he was going to the beach with his friends, brought a change of clothes in his backpack, couldn't wear any glitter because it would be on him, and made sure not to have his face in any pictures, but just had to get out there to see tens of thousands of people supporting him is not doing it because he wants to make a statement about the occupation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
The global LGBTQ movement needs to be supporting its partners in Israel and the Palestinian territories alike. Without them, we cannot fight the battles that we still need to fight. And to tell us that we can't celebrate our victories, and we need to celebrate our victories, because how do you keep on fighting if you can't acknowledge what you've already won from waging similar battles? Then we can't go on. We can't be told that in recognizing the standard that we've created for ourselves and are still fighting for other sectors of the LGBTQ population, such as the trans community and the Arab community and the ultra-Orthodox community.
I just also recently saw a video, I think it was AJ Plus or something, you know, talking about hypocrisy and double standards. You know, they published pro-LGBTQ videos in English and in other languages, but in Arabic they don't.
Yeah.
And I think I saw a video about how the Tel Aviv parade is basically pinkwashing. And you know what? Okay, Sababa, the LGBTQ parade is a party, and it's overrated and it's disproportional in comparison to what's actually happening in this country. But in addition to the parade in Tel Aviv, there are parades in over 30 different cities in this country. I mean, the parade in Jerusalem, it's not a party. It's not an attempt to pinkwash. It's a protest. It's a sign of we exist. We're here. I mean, talking about unity and I guess the global struggle, it's always interesting to me to remind people that a few years ago, local religious figures in Jerusalem, Jewish, Muslim, and Christians, all came together, united, in their demand to the municipality to not allow the gays to march in the city. Yeah. So our struggle has barely anything to do with the political approach and the policies of the government of Israel. Mm. We're individuals that have come together as a community, and yes, we are involved in the political circles because that is the main way you can actually influence the discourse of things in this country. But we're not, our struggle is not an attempt to shift the conversation from talking about what bad things this country is doing to, oh my God, how much of a safe haven it is for LGBTQ people. It's definitely not as simple as that. And any attempt to cancel our struggle is setting back our global struggle, not only our regional struggle that is very, very, stands behind in comparison to other places in the world, but it really sets back our global struggle for actual LGBTQ equality.
Mm. So, Linda, you're right. This is all about individuals as well as communities. And you had a wonderful story on Haaretz.com recently about the intersection between religion and gender politics. Tell us about Yoram.
So I have been trying to write this story for a year and a half now. And I was finally allowed. Long story short, for a year I dated a wonderful, wonderful person, a transgender man by the name of Yehoram, who comes from I would say, ultra-Orthodox family. He is the second youngest of seven children, went through the Haredi and Dati Leumi, like national religious education system, did national service as a religious woman, and transitioned, and his parents love and accept him. His family loves and accepts him. And not despite their religiosity and not despite their background, but specifically because of it. They know their religion. They know Judaism inside and out. And when I sat down with his parents recently to have this conversation, it was mostly a conversation with his parents, they told me about the Kabbalistic concept of reincarnation and how much that can influence the soul within the body. They believe that a Jewish soul can be reincarnated into basically anything. And of course, a man's soul can be born into a woman's body. So,
I was interested to note that Yehoram's mother was keen to point out her opposition to pride parades.
Oh, yeah.
And she blamed, you know, the scanty clothes and the glitter, as you put it, on the left. So there is this this intersection between conservatism, I mean, or rather there is there is room for conservatism and acceptance of one's transgender child to coexist.
For sure. And I found that particularly interesting as well. I knew them. I've known them for a long time. I know their voting patterns. I've spent a while in that house. And I love them very much. And they love me very much. And at the end of the day, you don't need to necessarily ascribe to the full litany of liberal beliefs in order to see an LGBTQ person as a human being and accept them as they are. There is a very Western perception, and I think a very Western normative perception, that this is what it means to be a progressive person, and this is what it means to be a conservative person, and that's not necessarily how it works in reality. You know, you can be two elderly religious people who were born in Yemen and who grew up in refugee camps and then shacks and then a house in the periphery, who find their own way through their own worldview to accept their child in a way that I have seen very few secular people accept their child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a counselor in this LGBT youth group, I've had to remove children from their homes. I remember one case in particular, a kid called me and he was very much shaken. We were on the phone for 3 hours. He said, I know I can't tell you that I want to kill myself because then you'll have to call the police. So instead, I'm just going to talk around it for a little while. And we managed to get him into a shelter. And these parents, Yoram's parents, know that this is the case, know that this is the reality for so many people, and said, God forbid this happens to any more children. We don't care who you are. We don't care how God created you. We love you no matter what.
Mm.
We accept you no matter what. Live your life as you want to live it, as you have to live it.
Mm-hmm. That is a lovely sentiment to start wrapping up this episode. Mohammed, you wrote in your op-ed that your family struggled at first when you came out. How are things now?
Again, I mean, it feels like Linda and I are sort of thinking in the same way about these issues because, look, I come from a sort of half secular, half religious family. My mother is a conservative Muslim. She's religious. She prays 5 times a day. She fasts. She's pretty much religious.
Mm.
And in the beginning, I mean, when I first told her that I was gay, it was over the phone. That's how I came out to my mother. The first thing she said after a long moment of silence, it was a short moment of silence that felt like forever, but the first thing she said was, I don't completely understand what you're trying to tell me. I love you, and I want you to come back home. And, you know, when she said to me, come back home, to me, that was all I needed to hear that moment. Because I had to know that I still have a home, and it's definitely a privilege in an underprivileged communities in this country. And it does really, and I guess today the situation is much better. I mean, a lot of heart, you know, there were a lot of ups and downs, obviously. It was never simple. And a lot of challenging things came up. You know, my mother would always, in the beginning, at least say to me, you know, what other people are going to say?
Mm-hmm.
Am I ever going to be a grandmother? You know, the typical Middle Eastern, you know, concerns of a mother. I guess the fact that she brags about, you know, all of her gay friends to me, I guess reflects, you know, the process that she's been through. But it's important to remember that in this part of the world, the standards, the social standards are very different from the Western world. Because, you know, I mean, if we look, you know, we talked a little bit about politics, but if we look at our political parties, if you know, people assume that only, you know, progressive left-wing parties are going to be gay friendly, but in this country the entire conversation is very different, and you can definitely be conservative in social, in political issues, or in regional issues and in other issues, and yet still be accepting of other people, or even LGBTQ friendly. I mean, we have to say, I mean, whether we like it or not, the first openly gay minister in this country came from the Likud party, Benjamin Netanyahu's party. And whether that is an attempt to appeal to more liberal Israelis to vote for him or not, it happened in the Likud and it happened in conservative circles in this country, and it got more and more conservative people to actually, you know, normalize and accept our existence in general and as productive members of society. So it's important to remember that. So, and I guess the same thing is happening with the wider community, wider family. I mean, they are struggling. I mean, I think I'm the first family member to come out of the closet. There are still family members that are struggling, but also there are other family members that are starting to, you know, ask interesting questions, not always very gay-friendly questions, but questions out of curiosity. And to me, you know, that's my role. I mean, challenges and hardship are part of my experience and who I am. And as part of my experience, I have to expose as much people as possible to my perspective and my experience. And that way we can actually normalize who we are in society.
Guys, I'm afraid we really do have to wrap things up there. It's been a fascinating discussion. Mohammed, been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Linda, great to see you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you too to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back on Monday with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, Shabbat Shalom from Tel Aviv.